Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting today from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in the Twin Cities. Thanks so much for listening. And we begin this hour with the same kind of lying malarkey you've come to expect from the mainstream media. I mean, actually, it's the in-depth truth that you rely on here on public radio, where we would never consider stretching the truth for a moment. It's all about who you trust, right? Whatever story is being told to you. I spent nearly an hour talking with Dustin Hoffman, telling great stories about his movie days, and at a certain point, I didn't care if he was exaggerating anymore. I just trusted him. I mean, Dustin Hoffman. You'll hear a part of that conversation later this hour. But in the news biz, how much you have riding on the outcome of the story in some ways determines what you believe in the news. In a different way, in your favorite TV series, you believe what you want. In your superpower president of the most powerful nation on Earth. And is that claim getting a little dubious, by the way? It's all how much you trust and if you're willing to suspend your disbelief, whether you allow a lie to pass. We're going to talk about that later this hour. And we've managed to weave all of this together into an hour about the mechanics of honesty and dishonesty, the power of clarity in superpower politics, the danger of ambiguity when you end a TV show, stay tuned for that, and how a distorted bit of truth changed America back in 1988, and how we are still sorting out the human costs. We begin with Ian Brenner, though. He's founder of the Eurasia Group, a political research and consulting firm. His new book is called Superpower, Three Choices for America's Role in the World. Ian Brenner, welcome back to The Takeaway.
John, always good to be with you.
So, Ian, part of the theme of this book is we need more clarity coming from Washington and coming from the American government as far as foreign governments are concerned. Is that to say that the American government needs to be more honest or just needs to speak more clearly?
Well, we need a purpose. We need a mission. I mean, I think the purpose of the book, we remain the world's only superpower. That is utterly clear as I'm sitting in the studio and watching record highs in the markets yet again. And yet we don't really know what it means. We don't know what we stand for. The American people no longer know what it is the United States is supposed to be doing around the world. And Lord knows our allies, therefore, are very confused. And that's created all sorts of headlines that make it very clear that even though the United States is not in decline, American foreign policy influence very much is.
So what should we do? You have three basic points that you want to make. What I'd like to do is focus on one serious contradiction in American values and in American policy that you point to again and again in this great book. The mission of the American government to protect Americans, to keep us secure, and the mission of the American government to protect values of freedom. It seems to me they are fundamentally at odds. If you look at the NSA, the surveillance of the American people by the NSA, and the notion that Americans expect that we're going to be protected from terrorism. Those are irreconcilable policy aims at this point, it seems.
They're becoming much more so, especially because the American government has been seen to be lying about them, both in terms of the extent of American surveillance abroad and also within the United States. And there are perfectly legitimate reasons to take either of those paths to say, look, you know, terrorism is an enormous concern. We have the best cyber capabilities in the world. That's going to mean giving up significant amounts of our own personal liberties. And it also means taking unilateral steps internationally, even if that means allies are going to be upset, like Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, when we're spying on her. You can say that. You can do that. That's very different from a policy that says, actually, you know, we can't protect every single American at all times, but we can stand up for what we believe to be American values, the ones that were enshrined in our Declaration of Independence, and the ones that are written on the Statue of Liberty. I mean, you mentioned the contradictions around surveillance. We could talk about the contradictions in Syria. We have 4 million refugees. America so far has taken in 355. That number to me seems low, and yet there's no one on the 2016 scene running for president that has remotely begun to even address that issue.
Do people around the world have a fatigue with American talk about democracy? We had some African writers in the studio a few days ago who were saying we're sick and tired of the American talk of democracy, that we want policies that matter in the sort of ways in which we do things in our own countries. And America just doesn't seem to get that. Do you think that we need to lead with our values but not preach a certain kind of democracy when we talk about interventions around the world? And let's speak of Syria.
What's very clear is that if we are going to speak about values, we have to actually back them up. What we've been doing is continuing to speak about values while not actually adhering to them at home and not being willing to actually put muscle into it abroad. I mean, we talk about sovereignty in Ukraine, but we're not going to actually provide the kind of support to the Ukrainians that would lead them to enforce it, nor are we going to punish the Russians sufficiently or the countries that are helping the Russians, like China, that's going to make the Russians take it seriously. If we wanted to talk about democracy in Syria, we'd have to actually be prepared to spend the kind of money long term and also send the kind of forces on the ground that would allow us to speak with some level of seriousness and commitment. We're not prepared to do that. Much more likely is what we see in places like Hong Kong, where we say we're very concerned that the Chinese government is abrogating their deal to allow the Hong Kong Chinese to actually vote for their leaders, but we're clearly not going to do anything about it. That's why I think you're getting this sense of both irritation and profound disappointment from countries and people around the world. And you can see it last week when Obama invites six Gulf state leaders to come and have a summit with them, and the week beforehand four decide they're not going to show up. Or today, when you have for the first time the Russians in history, the Russians and the Chinese doing joint military exercises in the Mediterranean. I can give you so many of these headlines. It's very obvious that what the Americans have to say internationally just isn't carrying the weight it has historically.
Well, the great thing about Ian Bremmer's book, Superpower, Three Choices for America's Role in the World, is that he does not believe the complexity has outstripped the ability of Washington to handle some of these problems. I highly recommend it. Ian Bremmer is the founder of the Eurasia Group, a political research and consulting firm. Thanks so much, Ian.
My pleasure, John.
What is the route from teenager to radical? How does someone go from Apple Valley, Minnesota, to the front lines of the self-proclaimed Islamic State?
Just another day in the life of a gangster in the hood, feel me? Apple Valley. Nigga was bored out here, so, you know, decided to make a little quick-ass, you know, video showing what life's like in the projects.
It's the voice of Haned Mohalim, who grew up in Apple Valley, a suburb of the Twin Cities. On March 9th, 2014, Mohalim flew to the Middle East to fight with a self-proclaimed Islamic State. He's now presumed dead. Others have tried and failed. Six Minnesota men were recently intercepted by federal agents after they tried to obtain fake passports and travel to Syria. Why and how do Somali Americans go from being regular kids to ISIS warriors fighting overseas? Sitting next to me now here in the studio is Laura Ewan. She's a reporter here at Minnesota Public Radio and has been covering this topic in great detail. Laura, welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
So where did you have to sort of dive into to find out what was going on in these communities that aren't necessarily interested in talking to reporters?
That's right. Well, I have to give a lot of credit to my colleague Mukhtar Ibrahim, who's actually a Somali American journalist, which is still pretty unique, even in the Twin Cities, home to the largest Somali community in the country. But we have been just trying to go deep into the community, trying to talk to folks who, as you say, are a little bit mistrustful of reporters, not to sensationalize it, but just to really understand what could send some of these kids who were normal by every sense of the word to a battlefield in ISIS.
And some of their friends are as mystified as reporters are. Yeah. Here's a kid named Zach, who is a friend of Abdullahi Yusuf, who last month pleaded guilty to playing a minor role in a conspiracy to help ISIS. Listen.
Towards the end of our friendship, he was a bit of a loner. He would take a step back from basketball. You could actually tell the transition from being a guy that was outgoing to a guy that was kind of saying that he was becoming more mature, you know, acting like a man.
This didn't necessarily disturb Zach, but looking back, he sees the change.
That's right. I mean, what he's describing is almost like this textbook scenario of what it may look like from an outsider looking in as to how someone could be radicalized. Someone who, you know, was outgoing in the beginning. Abdullahi was someone who, he was 18 years old. He was one of the hoopers, they described him at the mosque. Someone who's playing basketball 24/7, would even sort of, you know, talk a little trash on the court. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, he just withdrew. He declined invitations to go to the movies at night, saying he had to really focus. He was becoming, you know, a little bit more religious. And it's a mystery to friends like Zach as to what truly happened.
It's less of a mystery to some of these folks who have family back in the Middle East and in the region, where there's profound pull of the family connections in ways that are sometimes unpredictable. Here's Ayan Abdurrahman, whose 19-year-old son, Zakaria Abdurrahman, is accused of taking the bus to New York with hopes of traveling to Syria from there.
20 days ago, Al-Shabaab killed my niece, who graduated from college. We have a problem on that front. On the other hand, we are losing our educated sons, our future. We are losing them for no reasons after they are being brainwashed. And that's the biggest problem.
So she's talking about changes taking place both overseas and here in this community.
Yeah, and I think what is really underscored in her comment is that Somalis have long felt victimized by terror groups like Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And now this woman, Ayan, has to confront this allegation that her own son tried to become a terrorist. And I've been to these pretrial hearings where I've seen her cry silently, and you get the sense that this scenario was just unimaginable to her, seeing her son in a prison jumpsuit facing these kind of charges.
And so she feels very alone, and it's one of the questions for reporters and for people trying to assess what's going on in this community. Does law enforcement and the FBI play the proper role here? Here are some protesters who really feel that the FBI has overstepped its bounds. Listen. Now, if you listen to Fox News, of course, they say, why aren't moderates in the community stepping up to control this? We have to have the FBI in there. But really, people in the community, as you've seen, find this very disruptive, the ways in which the FBI is infiltrating groups and families.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. And I think a lot of the moderate Muslims are speaking out. I mean, the majority of the Somali community, of course, condemns the actions of ISIS. What you're hearing in that clip is this, I guess, a sense of just being freaked out. You know, six young men, ages 19 to 21, were arrested on these charges. They never made it out of the country. And there is a sense in the community that maybe the government is overstepping its boundaries. You have to understand that the U.S. attorney in Minnesota, Andy Lugar, at the same time he's the chief prosecutor of these cases, he's also developing a program intended to expand social services in the Somali community that's supposed to prevent radicalization. So these are things like youth mentoring, college scholarships, soccer leagues. These are things that people in the Somali community have long called out for as a way to prevent men from feeling disaffected as they grow up here.
Before we go, do people believe that at the bottom of this case, some truth will be found as to what happened to these boys, how they were turned, what they actually were intending to do?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, there's the sense that they don't know everything. There was a, you know, 30 to 40 page criminal complaint that sort of listed the actions of these guys, but so much still needs to be uncovered. And hopefully if this does go, you know, this progresses through the courts, we'll hear a lot more.
Minnesota Public Radio reporter Laura Yuen, she's covering the radicalism and the disruptions in the Somali community here in the Twin Cities. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing basic tools for individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, 24/7 customer support, and more. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway.
This podcast of The Takeaway is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International. I'm John Hockenberry. Our partners include WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and The New York Times. If you'd like to know more about the program, you can find out more about me and the team at thetakeaway.org. What would it be like to take a long, slow walk in the park with a legend like Dustin Hoffman?
I've known De Niro for so many years, and we're very close, and it's very Bob to just come up to you and start talking like he's in the middle of a conversation, you know. And he said, so do you remember 1969? It's typical Bob to do that. And I said, what? He says, remember, you were at a benefit for Eugene McCarthy. He said, do you remember that? I said, I guess, kind of. Why are you bringing that up now? And he just looked at me and says, I was your waiter.
Well, I got to just ask questions and listen to Hoffman tell stories of a half century of acting, storytelling, and creating characters that are as alive to us as he is, the autistic savant Raymond Babbitt in Barry Levinson's Rain Man.
Of course, I don't have my toothpicks.
No, you don't need toothpicks. I was okay in the hotel last night with the pizza, but in a restaurant, you need a fork.
Of course, I don't have my toothpicks.
You don't need toothpicks, Ray. The pancakes keep sliding off. You can eat with a fork.
I don't have my maple syrup either. I'm going to be without my maple syrup and my toothpicks.
You don't see any pancakes, do you, Ray?
Of course, the promised maple syrup is not here.
Ray, when we order the pancakes, they're going to bring the maple syrup.
Maple syrup is supposed to be on the table before the pancakes.
We haven't ordered yet, Ray.
Of course, when they bring the maple syrup after the pancakes, it'll definitely be too late.
Or the producer hired by the CIA to stage a war, Stanley Moss, in Wag the Dog.
You want me to produce your war? Not a war. It's a pageant. We need a theme, a song, some visuals. We need, you know, it's a pageant. It's like the Oscars. That's why we came to you.
I never won an Oscar.
And that's a damn shame you didn't. But you produced the Oscars.
Yes, indeed, I did. You know, you're a writer. That's your script. You're a director. But if you're the producer, what did you do? See, nobody knows what you do. The producer, I mean, all he's got is the credit. You see? Some plaques on the wall. They don't know what we do.
Stan.
Don't get me started.
Stan.
Yes.
The two-time Oscar-winning Hoffman is now 77, and I got the chance that he and a team from Los Angeles are giving anyone online a master class, it's called, with a legendary artist. Hoffman spoke to me with no ground rules about how he prepares for roles, what movie-making means. It was a priceless phone conversation that meandered like a walk through a grand castle of memory.
You know, I never went to college, and one of my favorite parts of acting has always been being able to do research, which is kind of like going to class. And Rain Man, I was able to do over 2 years of research, so I was able to meet two autistic people that I thought, you know, would be good to jump off from or reference, I guess. Nevertheless, when we started shooting the first few days, I couldn't do anything because usually I just internalize whatever I'm doing in preparation, and then I don't practice on camera. I just show up the first day and see what comes out. And unfortunately, what came out was, I thought, just a lot of derivative stuff I had done from other movies. It was like part Grazzo Rizzo, part Papillon, and I was so dismayed. By the third day, I just said to my wife, I said, I have to get out of this picture. And I told Barry that I wanted to leave the film. And he said, well, I promise you that if you stay in the film, we can reshoot any or all of it you want to when we're done. I make you that promise, because he said, I think at some point you're going to drop into it. And I said, well, you know, I hope so. And I think a few weeks later, Tom Cruise and I were doing a scene in the Buick. The director, Barry, stayed back watching it on a monitor. And he said, okay, we've got a couple more takes you can probably do and just improvise. And apparently what I had done is, not knowing what to say, because I didn't know how the character thought, I would just every once in a while, after an answer to Tom Cruise's improvisation, I would just say, yeah, yeah. And he said, you know what I mean? I said, yeah. And he said, that's your character. And I said, you're right. And once that happened, I was okay. I could just drop in.
And Wag the Dog was just the opposite of that?
No, Wag the Dog was the same. I knew what I did not want to do. The character had been described, I thought, in a rather cliche form. He was a fat, bald, cigar-smoking producer that sat around the Beverly Hills Hotel swimming pool. So I knew immediately, I don't want to do that. I can't do that. And so Barry said, well, then, you know, don't do anything. And he had a costume for me, which I guess I had tried on before, just in terms of different costumes. And this costume was a silk bathrobe. And my father had a silk bathrobe. And suddenly, by wearing that silk bathrobe. Inadvertently, I was kind of doing my father, and that's how the character happened halfway through the first day.
It was brilliant. What do you think an archive like this this masterclass project means, do you think?
Well, certainly only a record of my personal feelings, because I guarantee you there will be a lot of people, whether they're directors or producers or studio executives or actors for that matter, who will disagree with a lot of what I say. And that's why I think I kept saying this is just my feelings. Actors work in so many different ways depending on the project. I do wish that some of what I said had been said to me. I think the most important thing is what I said about auditions, because actors, you know, will tell you that it's nothing to audition for 10 years and not get anything. What Duvall told me, we were roommates, he said many times the worst actors get the part, because the producers and the director really want to see the character when you do an audition. And actors who have studied and with one of these, let's say, giants of acting teachers would say you have to find the character. There's a system of finding a character, and you kind of start from zero, which is really what Nichols had us do in rehearsal for The Graduate. And as Duvall said, the actors that have the character for an audition, and they haven't even rehearsed yet, they're just auditioning, will give you a derivative character. They'll give you a cliche, and they give you the most superficial one. But the director and the producer say, oh, yes, now we know what we're going to get. And that's why Duvall said that those actors used to call what you see is what you get.
Dustin Hoffman, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for making it easy.
Actor Dustin Hoffman on his latest online venture called Masterclass.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
If in the world of science filmmaking and storytelling, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is our explainer of the vast astro world of the cosmos...
The universe is 13.8 thousand million years old. In order to imagine all of cosmic time, let's compress it into a single calendar year.
You might say that in the less vast but perhaps more relevant world of the human conscience, perhaps it's behavioral economist Dan Ariely who explains it all for us.
Yes, there's some big cheaters out there, but they're very rare. And because of that, their overall economic impact is relatively low. On the other hand, we have a ton of little cheaters. And because there are so many of us, the economic impact of small cheating is actually incredibly, incredibly high.
Talking about all the little cheaters out there, that's Duke University professor Dan Ariely in the new film Dishonesty, The Truth About Lies. It's a documentary that takes on the puzzles of morality and the soul the way an astrophysicist might explain a supernova. Ariely is the author of The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, and Yael Melamed is the film's director, writer, and producer. Both Yael and Dan are in New York in the studios of WNYC. Yael and Dan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Our pleasure. Nice to be here.
There is such a proliferation of lies in the world, and people feel bad about it, but they also talk openly about it. What narrative here do we want to explore in this exploration of lying and dishonesty?
So I'll tell you how this came about. So as you know, I've been doing experiments on small cheating. I've been tempting people to steal money from me, and I see how much money they steal and what causes them to steal more or less. But the question emerged, to what extent is the little cheating the same as big cheating? And are those different animals, or is it really kind of the same psychological process? So Yael and I basically decided to start interviewing people, and we interviewed each person for about 3 hours in a very intimate interview. what we learned, A, was that the stories were amazing. People were incredibly generous. They were revealing lots of things about what happened to them. And we realized that the stories of large cheating doesn't start with a planned process. It starts very much like the same research we find in the lab, that people take little small steps that they can justify, and then the steps become bigger and bigger, and people are still able to justify them until at some point they get caught, and then the world kind of breaks down and things change dramatically.
Let's hear the sound of some of those people that you interviewed. This is from the film Dishonesty.
I knew it was wrong. I didn't know how illegal it was. I figured it was illegal. I just didn't think I was going to get caught.
When you have that the mindset, or when you think that everybody else is doing it, it makes it a lot easier to consider what you've done is legitimate.
I'm pretty sure I convinced myself that I wasn't harming anything or anyone.
Yael, how did you decide to choose these characters, and what did you choose to follow to show us something about lying?
Well, you know, we interviewed about 30 people, and the stories were, as Dan says, incredible. In the final choice, it was really people who fit somewhat Dan's research and could reflect back some of what he'd learned in the lab, and who we felt we could all relate to. So we were very interested in the people who were very human and very relatable.
What was the challenge of making this world seem like a kind of inner universe that you can explore? I mean, obviously the relationship to cosmos is absurd, but on some level, people really need to see familiar territory when you're exploring dishonesty to find what you found in themselves, right, Yael?
Well, we made a conscious decision not to go for people at the extremes, not to go for sociopaths, and not to go for people who lie out of desperation. We really wanted to look for people that everybody or people could see themselves in. So maybe not everybody would see themselves in every character, but they would see themselves in some of them.
Yeah. And you know, the analysis to cosmos. So, you know, I don't have such a nice accent as Neil, but I think it is interesting that when we look at what is unknown, we think about the cosmos as the great unknown, right? Here's the vast space. We understand very little about it and so on. But I think our brains and our behavior are actually more unknown to us than the cosmos. So one of the things that is very clear about dishonesty is that we don't understand how it works in us, right? The moment you have a conflict of interest, you don't see how it could influence your own behavior. You don't see how it influences the people around you. You don't understand these initial steps and how they can lead to a slippery slope. So it's true that, you know, the cosmos is vast, but I think our lack of understanding and maybe the contrast between how little we understand and how much we think we understand is much more problematic when it comes to human behavior and our own mind.
And here's an example of lies that were quite literally earth-shaking. Here's a montage that you talk about in your film. I don't know if you consider these people to be sociopaths, but they're certainly standing up in front of everyone and telling things that are not true. Listen.
Well, we don't torture people. Let me say that again to you. We don't torture people.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were.
Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir.
It does not.
Not wittingly.
General James Clapper of the CIA speaking with Senator Ron Wyden, and George Tenet and Donald Rumsfeld before Congress talking about the lead-up to the Iraq War. What do you think was going on there, Dan?
So, you know, when you look at it in the outside, you say it's impossible that these guys are not lying and that they know it, right? I mean, it just seems crazy that they're not kind of just lying completely. But here is my guess. Of course, we couldn't do experiments on those guys. But my guess is if you connected them to a lie detector, it wouldn't register anything. By that time, they were so deep into self-deception that they were truly believing what they were saying. And self-deception is a particularly interesting thing. It's about the fact that sometimes we have pressures to believe something. It could be an ideology. It could be that a particular act is okay. It could be a reconstruction of memory. It could be all kinds of things. And the amazing thing, and we have lots of experiments on this, is that very easily we can convince ourselves that reality is actually different than what it was. Now, we go along, and the more often we tell ourselves these stories, the more we believe them. And to some degree, you could also, by the way, with all types of lying, you can think about that it's not all bad, right? There's some good things about it. There's some things we just don't want to face every day. There's some things we don't want to believe every day. So this need to justify our own behavior and believe something different about reality has some kind of psychological benefit. Of course, it has also tremendous cost.
Dan Ariely is a behavioral economist at Duke University, author of The Honest Truth About Dishonesty and producer of Dishonesty, The Truth About Lies. Yael Melamed is director, writer, and producer of Dishonesty, The Truth About Lies. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The film is playing on Friday at the IFC Center in New York. It will also be available online. And here's something to take with you today. In the fine print of the classifieds of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the 934th Airlift Wing of the Air Force Reserve reminds people to stay away from Fort Snelling because there may be shooting out there. You have to call Sergeant Nelson Espada if you think you have a reason to go there. Also, there's a gun and knife show today out at the Waconia Ice Arena. A nice love seat is for sale for $200. And lost class ring gold in South Minneapolis in early May from class of 1926. Reward. There's got to be a story there. That's all for us from Minneapolis. But if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.